the mass incarceration of millions of Americans, immigrants hiding in fear in the shadow of our society, unemployment, homelessness, poverty, hunger, or the renewed struggle for voting rights. So I said to each one of us today, we must never, ever give up. We must never, ever give in. We must keep the faith and keep our eyes on the prize.
KBOO Portland.
Good evening. This is Transpositive PDX on KBOO Radio here in Portland. And I am Jean Bryant. I am one of your co-hosts this evening. I use she and her pronouns. And joining me is Emma Lugo. Emma?
I am Emma. I use she and her pronouns.
And with us tonight, we have Ira. Ira is a transmasculine author. We're going to speak with Ira about their book and their experience. Ira lived in Portland for a while. Ira, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, I am Ira Feinstein. I am an author who currently lives in Chicago, Illinois, although I was a transplant from the Midwest to the Pacific Northwest for almost 20 years.
Hey, so welcome back to Portland.
Thank you.
Yeah, how does it feel to be back in Portland?
Feels good. Very familiar. Very familiar.
It's after dark, so we can't show you the gray skies. But
yeah.
Now, anyway, welcome, Ira.
Welcome.
And okay, so tell us about this book that you have written. Where are you in terms of its publication?
Okay, great. My book is not yet published. I'm currently looking for a publisher slash agent. And if anybody out there has ever tried to get a book published, you know that it is a very arduous process. It reminds me of being an elephant, a pregnant elephant, where they're pregnant for, you know, what, like two or three years or something, just an insane amount of time. But my book is about the breast cancer 1 mutation. For those of you who don't know, it's a mutation that can increase your risk of breast and ovarian cancer. For breast cancer, up to 78%, and for ovarian cancer, up to 50%. And the book is about being diagnosed with that mutation and sort of exploring what it is to grow up in a body, because I knew that I had that mutation before I was tested for it at the age of 20. Growing up in a body that feels so unsafe. I mean, of course, we have so many reasons that our bodies can feel unsafe. But for me, my body felt unsafe because my mother died of breast cancer when she was 43 years old. Her mother died of what I thought was breast cancer. It ended up being ovarian cancer when she was 52 years old. And then my father's mother had also died of cancer. And so I came to the conclusion at a very young age, at 11, that I was also going to die of cancer. That just seemed like the most natural thing. You look to your parents to see what's going to happen to you when you grow up, and all I saw was death. And I decided at 11 to get my breast cut off. It was very uncomfortable to grow up in that body. And also, at the time, I was having gender issues, no issues, quote unquote, but I didn't quite know where to place them because I had so many other things going on that I wasn't sure if my gender identity and how I felt about myself was internalized matrophobia or if it was some authentic part of myself that I didn't know how to express, especially growing up in the Midwest in the 90s in a small town.
Ira, do you think that I understand that the mutation is a huge thing. I mean, especially, I remember when all that stuff was coming out. I mean, I remember Gwyneth Paltrow and her story. I remember the story of how many folks within like the Ashkenazi community like were also discovering that they had this mutation. And I remember the public health conversations that were happening at the time. And, you know, basically talking about how this is a really important public health conversation that people who have this possibility in their lives now have the potential to take really dramatic steps to save their lives. But I also understand how when you tell me your story, it's conflated with the experience of like coming into your awareness of yourself as transgender or non-binary or gender fluid. So I would love it if during our conversation we could explore a little bit about, like, did you ever feel, even when you were back at 11, because I remember what it was like for me when I was like 5 or 6, did you ever wonder, like, back at 11 even, if maybe you didn't want the body that you thought you were going to be inheriting? Like, did you, I mean, in addition to wanting to protect yourself and your, you know, your awareness of your mortality, did you ever, like, at, even at that young age, realize, I don't want this body anyways?
I don't know that I focused on it 11. The first time I had any inkling of being trans or being other was watching the Phil Donahue show in the 80s. Kate Bornstein was on
I love Kate Bornstein. She was our first guest on Transpositive.
Oh, wow, that's so awesome. And I watched her and the way she spoke about her experience, and this light bulb went off, and the light bulb was, uh-oh. Because I knew that I recognized her experience, and I was so scared because I could see everything she had to go through just in the microcosm of that one TV show to live her path. Not that I was thinking all of that at such a young age, but I was scared. And I also kind of thought, well, I'm just a Tom girl. You know, there's so much room to be a Tom girl, you know? I feel like there's more room to express that part of yourself if you're a girl than certainly there is if you're a boy and you want to express a more feminine inside of yourself. And so there was that part of me. And when I would look in the mirror, I was very clear that I didn't want my breasts, you know, that I wanted to have masculine pecs and I wanted to be a bodybuilder and have this male physique. I knew that, but I didn't know once I became so scared of having breasts, I didn't know that if I got them cut off when I woke up from a surgery, would I look down and realize that I had never connected fully with my body and I'd missed this chance to really be fully embodied because of my fear. Because when I had breasts, you know, when you're being intimate with somebody, they want to touch them. They want to experience, they want to bring you pleasure. And I wouldn't allow that to happen. And part of it was gender dysphoria. And part of it was that I didn't want to become too attached to them because I knew they were going to be gone. And so I think on so many levels, it was all woven together. And what I did with my gender was I put it towards the back, and I allowed the mutation, and I allowed getting my breasts removed because of the mutation to become the story. I didn't have to tell people that I wanted a flat chest. It was just because I had to have, you know, this life-saving surgery. Of course, my friends I could tell, but my family I didn't tell. That was, you know, I wasn't going to go there. That was too complicated, it felt.
That's so great. I mean, it's so rare in our circles. I'm kind of doing some insider speak here too, but it's so rare within like trans circles and within like the community, which is pretty big, to really have authentic conversations about like how we feel about our body parts and like the complicated feelings that we have about them. There's just this assumption that like, well, you had this body part and it was the wrong part for you. And obviously when you like fix it so that you fit into the binary, then everything is going to be great. And you know, there's so much between the point of like having this awareness, this identity that, oh hey, I am different, and getting to that point like where you're comfortable with whatever choices you make, and to have like an authentic conversation about that whole range of feelings is amazing. So I thank you so much.
Yeah. And Ira, if I may, I observe, because as I always never miss a chance to say in these interviews, I've got a few years on you. You know, I transitioned a while ago. And the difference in perspective between having made some of these initial decisions, I think I heard you say at 11 years old, so right at puberty, beginnings of puberty, that's a much different experience than so many have, you know? And I don't know, that's interesting. So how does this weave into the storyline of your book, the narrative of your book? Is your book autobiographical in that sense?
Or
do you approach it tangentially?
No, it's definitely memoir, completely 100% memoir, with a little bit of social commentary, of course, thrown in, but definitely mostly memoir.
Ira, how's your book coming along? Have you had much progress with getting the story that you want to tell in your book?
Definitely, no problem with that. Right now, I'm looking for agents. I hired my girlfriend to be my publicist, and so she's sending out the pitches for me because the rejection is a bit daunting and demoralizing. So I don't want to see it. Just tell me if there's good news. That's what I say.
What is the name of your book?
Cut Off.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
That's pretty.
Right to the point. But it's certainly, it's not just about being cut off or having your breast cut off. It's about being cut off from your body, or because I was an orphan, because my father had died when I was 9. And then I was placed into a new family living with my godmother and her 5 children and her husband, along with my younger brother, and not wanting that family and not wanting that life. It's also being cut off from them and being cut off from people in general. Because after my parents died, I made a conscious decision that love was not worth the risk. It was not worth the heartache. It was not worth everything that you would have to lose again. And so I didn't let anybody in for most of my life until probably my mid-30s. Was I actually able to be open with people? But, you know, our body is just one piece of how we move through the world.
Yeah.
And how we move people.
It sounds like a lot of your story is about a trauma also, and how trauma like affects families, how it affects individuals, and kind of how we end up having to like deal with trauma. It's something that, you know, we all have to deal with. I mean, whether we're transgender or not. And it sounds like a lot of your story is just about dealing with that trauma and dealing with, you know, the experiences of that.
Yeah, definitely.
So your father passed away when you were 9. What was his name?
Paul.
Paul? Were you close?
Yeah, I was daddy's little girl.
Oh, wow.
I always say that I never felt so loved by anybody as I did by my father. He was over the top and good at spoiling, which when you're a little kid is, you know, pretty special. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you had, did you have, you said you had one sibling?
I have one younger brother, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How has your younger brother, are you and your younger brother still friends?
Yeah, we're close. Mm-hmm.
And how did your younger brother respond to your transition?
Well, he at first, he was actually the first person I called. It was 2 a.m. when I decided to finally make the decision. And I called him and I said, you know, I'm transitioning, you can call me Ira. And he said, I love you no matter what, Brister, you know, brother, sister. And it was pretty much that simple. It was just love.
Oh, that's such a nice, that's so great.
Yeah, it's the story you always want people to hear, where they're just embraced and loved for who they are, and that's what I got.
Yeah. And what about your mother? What, like, not your stepmother, but did you know your birth mother?
Oh yeah, my birth mother, but she died when I was 11.
And she died when you were 11, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But I think, you know, looking back, of course, both of my parents had a sense of me being different than the typical girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I rejected everything that was associated with it. And they were very accommodating, I can say, especially looking back and thinking about growing up in the 80s and what parents knew or thought about then, and just the way that...
Do you have conversations with your mother this day?
Of course.
And how does that go? How do you feel about that? How do you feel about that?
Depends on the day, you know? I have conversations with both of my parents. I don't think that they never leave,
mm-hmm.
you know? And sometimes people think that when your parents are dead, that it's just flat experience, that it's some void that never ends. But and maybe this is in part because I was so young, but as I've aged, I've been able to look at my parents and who they were at different ages of their life from the adult lens. And so I'll have conversations with them, like, why were you so depressed? Why were you such a jerk? Why didn't you grow up and be a man? And, you know, and I will yell at my dead parents. I will laugh. I will cry. I will, out of the blue, just hear a song that we were all listening to, and you get that feeling that they're in your presence, and
I absolutely can relate, and that's why I asked the question.
Yeah.
Because both of my parents had passed when I chose to transition, and that's been a process, you know, question for me. And so I wondered how that had gone for you at a younger age than when I went through that.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes they still call me by my birth name when we're having conversations, and I'll have to say, no, I'm Ira. or you always knew this to be true, so get on the bandwagon and accept it already.
There you go. There you go, Dad.
Yep.
Yeah.
How do you feel like your parents would have responded to your transition had they been alive when you transitioned?
That's so complicated, because if my parents had been alive, then I don't know that I would have gone down that path with the mutation. And I wouldn't have had all of these essentially gender confirming surgeries because of the life-saving aspect of it. So it's quite hard for me to imagine how I would have come to be Ira had they been with me. I think my father would have had a hard time with it. You know, I was his this beautiful little girl with the long blonde hair and the bright blue eyes. And he, you know, he liked me rough and tumble. He liked me being a tomboy. I don't know if he expected me to grow out of it at some point. And I don't know about my mother, honestly. She was very conservative. In retrospect, I realize now she was very Christian and conservative Christian upbringing. And I'm sure times would have changed them, you know, as they would have if they had lived. But I think it would have been somewhat arduous path to come out to them and have to navigate that. It was somewhat free not have to worry about it, honestly. Mm-hmm. I had to worry about it with my adopted family, but it didn't have the same weight.
Let's talk about your adopted family then. So when your father passed away, first I want to make sure I have your story. So when your father passed away, did you still live with your mother, or did your mother?
Yeah, so what, my mom was sick. She got sick when I was in first grade, and kind of everybody was waiting for her to die. And then my father had a heart attack when I was in third grade. Mm-hmm. And so everybody was kind of shocked. And then they had to figure out, you know, what to do with the kids, because everybody knew my mom was going to die. And then a couple of years later, she did. Mm-hmm.
Was that ever a concern for you? I mean, one of the things that taking testosterone does is that, well, taking any kind of hormone, and pardon me, I haven't asked you any medical information and I don't really want to know. So I'm making more of a generalization that when you take hormones, it does affect like things like your blood pressure and your heart health. Was that a concern for you, knowing that you had that history with your father?
Yes. And it's something I'm dealing with at the moment, since I am on testosterone. I don't mind talking about it. And my cholesterol went through the roof, where when I was on estrogen, it was no problem at all. There was no issue. And I, in the last week, I'm just sort of having to, it's kind of sad. You know, I feel like, ugh, I did so much work to be Ira, and now is this testosterone gonna kill me in some horrible, you know, in some opposite way, that I did so much work not to die like my mother. I don't want to die like my father.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So your father died of a heart attack when you were 9. That must have been really, I'm so sorry. That must have been really hard to deal with.
Yeah, very shocking.
Yeah, and then the whole time that was happening, you also knew that your mother was gonna pass. Did you say she had ovarian cancer?
She had breast cancer.
She had breast cancer, okay. And so then you moved in with an adopted family. Was that like a family that was it relatives, or
was it my mother's best friend, my godmother?
Your godmother, okay. She
took my younger brother and me in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so they legally adopted you, and then you grew up with them?
No, they didn't. I say that my adopted family because that's sort of an easy shorthand. They didn't legally adopt us. Connie is my Connie is the person who raised me. She became my legal guardian. And my mother told Connie, who Connie told me years later, that if my brother and I ever asked to be adopted, to adopt us. But otherwise, don't worry about it. My brother actually, when he was in his 20s, got legally adopted. And what I didn't realize at the time, and what he didn't realize until afterward, is they change your birth certificate so that you don't have your birth parents on there anymore, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. But I feel like they adopted me. I don't need them to legally do it, but I could never have my birth parents' name taken off my birth certificate.
Did you have relations with your extended family at all at this time, like grandparents or aunts or uncles or anything?
My grandparents had already died. Mm-hmm. I have a weird family where on both sides, my grandparents died young and then their children died younger than them. Mm-hmm. These walls closing in. And then my mom had a couple brothers that I didn't talk to, and my dad had one brother that I didn't talk to. Mm-hmm. There were some cousins here or there, but mostly it was really being submerged in the new family and not having a lot of outside contact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So How was that moving in with, like, moving into a space then with a new family? I mean, you're coming of age, you know, as an adolescent, you're beginning to discover yourself, and here you are suddenly with this new family. How'd that go?
Because when my mother was, towards the end, we lived in Georgia, so we had to move to Michigan to be with Connie's family. So there was that culture shock of living in the South then versus being in the Midwest. And my mother was Lutheran, but my father was Jewish. And so growing up, we'd kind of had an amalgamation of, you know, holidays and culture and all of those things. And in the Midwest, where my Jerry, who was my, you know, non-adoptive, but essentially my father, he's of German stock, you know, and men are very silent and they're very calm and you don't really know anything that's going on with them, where my father had been effusive and loud and silly and giggly and had a range of emotions that I didn't see expressed by the men in Michigan at the time. And so there was that culture shock. And whereas my mother had been very loving and open and emotive as well as my father, Connie was very strict. She ran the household. You know, she had 7 kids when my brother and I moved in. She had a full-time job. She was getting her master's degree. And she ran us kind of like the military. You know, we had chores. We had all of these things. And so in certain ways, we were just, my brother and I were just put right into the system, you know, and we were treated like any of the other kids. But in some ways, it was just very startling because I was used to freedom and I was used to not having, you know, when your mom's sick and your other parent's dead, you can kind of do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. She can barely, you know, if you get too loud, she'll yell at you from her bed, but that's about all that's going to happen. So it was an adjustment to have that much constriction and rules and formal things like dinner every night.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So where do you mind if I ask, where in Georgia did you grow up?
Marietta. So it's a little outside of Atlanta. It's essentially where all the Northerners moved to, you know? South London.
The Chicago connection makes sense because I had an aunt and uncle from Chicago, and that's where they lived, was Marietta, up in the hills.
Yeah.
Wow. What a story. It sounds like you've got some really great material then for your book. We are talking tonight with, can I say your full name, Ira?
Yeah, Ira Feinstein.
Okay, great. We're talking tonight with Ira Feinstein. Ira is an author. He's writing a book called Cut Off, which is about his story as a transgender person, but it's also about dealing with the, you know, facing a lot of trauma at a very young age and having to deal with, you know, the realities of cancer and how cancer can like take your loved ones and how that affects you as a child and, you know, kind of growing up in this really complicated upbringing, which we're talking to Ira about, all in the midst of transitioning. So,
yeah. Ira,
go ahead, Jean, sorry.
You've shared a lot about your life, your lived experience. Let's shift more focus towards the book itself, if you will. I assume that everything that we've been talking about is reflected in the narrative of your book. What angle do you take in the book? Is the fact that you're trans and the trans aspects of your lived experience, are those primary or are they secondary or just somewhere woven into the tapestry of the narrative?
Yeah, so this is the first book ends when I'm 28, 26. And after I've had decided to have the prophylactic mastectomy. So I have a second book that's in process that deals very directly with my transition, but this first book is more the trans narrative is woven through, it's a little more subtle, because that's how I experienced it growing up. It wasn't the first thing in my awareness. You know, I had friends in their 20s and they were transitioning, and we would talk about it, and it wasn't like I wasn't aware of that. It was just sort of, I can't deal with that right now. There's too much else to sort through for me to really know how I feel about this part of myself and expressing this part of myself and letting the world know about it. And I wanted to make sure that it came from a place of solidity, as much as you can have when you're transitioning, and for me to know that it had nothing to do with all of the trauma. And I wish that that wasn't a question that I asked myself, or that I had to ask myself. But I think, you know, we live in a society that's very focused on psychological reasons. And I've had more than one person say, well, of course you transitioned. You're so scared of being a woman that you wanted to be a man. That makes complete sense. And I needed to know for myself that that wasn't where I came from. And that took a long time to sort out. It wasn't going to happen. For me, it wasn't going to happen in my 20s, because my 20s were a blur of 20s, you know. Yeah. I feel like life gets better as you get older. And I think especially most likely for trans people, the people I've talked to is, you know, the more years we have living as the person we want to live, everything shifts. It doesn't necessarily have to be earth-shaking, but there's a subtle change that you move through life with that has a calmness to it, at least for me.
That's so great. I mean, your story, so we're talking tonight with Ira Feinstein. Ira is an author and is working on two books, including his first book is called Cut Off, and it's about his story of coming of age as someone who is in the midst of transition and also dealing with issues of family loss and trauma. I'm really enjoying hearing your story, Ira. I really look forward to seeing your book when it does come out, because your ability to tell your story is just so fascinating and very engaging. I'm wondering, in your 20s then, so you were dealing with a lot of issues in your 20s, having to deal with trauma and kind of coming to an awareness of who you were. So tell me, let's see, where are you at this time? Are you still in the Midwest? You've lived with your adopted family, you've lost your father, you've lost your mother, you've moved in with us an adopted family. And you know, so now as you come of age, did you stay with your adopted family? What did you do then?
I went to Michigan State and completed my 4 years and got out as soon as I could and went to Portland. And it was in Portland that, when I was in Michigan in college, I came out as a lesbian, and it was not easy. And honestly, I think it was harder for me to be a lesbian in Michigan than it was for me to transition in Portland. It was that, you know, so people might think that, oh, transitioning could be the hardest thing you ever do in your life. For me, that is not the case. Being a lesbian in the Midwest was excruciating. Everything felt like it was under this microscope. And so I got out as soon as I could and was finally able to breathe in the Pacific Northwest, because nobody cared. How freeing is that? Nobody cared. It doesn't matter. Just what I always wanted. It doesn't matter. I just get to be a halfway decent person, and that's good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, all the other stuff is put aside. Yeah, so I moved and slowly started to grieve in a way that I think adults grieve, and not the way a child would grieve over my parents, and have relationships and try to find work that mattered and all of those more normal things that people do as they age.
Yeah. So you were in your 20s when you moved to Portland, which is, you know, it seems like everybody's in their 20s when they move to Portland.
Yeah, it's a good time to move there.
It is. Yeah, no, it is. But it sounds like in Portland you were able to, you know, have some freedom from some of the issues that like you had to deal with in the Midwest. So what specifically about Portland made it more freeing? Was it just the change for you personally, or were there things about your community and your experiences that were different?
There was a bigger queer community. It was, you know, there's a big lesbian community back then, very big. You know, they had the E Room and you had a whole lesbian bar, and it was one bar and everybody would go there on a Friday and Saturday night, and you knew that you'd run into somebody you knew or a handful of people you knew, and you'd probably find somebody to make out with. And that was amazing, you know? It was, because I feel like in Michigan, there was a very limited, narrow scope of what it is to be attractive, you know? And it's like a certain weight and a certain look, and just, and it didn't fit. And so I didn't know that I would move somewhere where it didn't matter what size you were, it didn't matter what was going on, that you could be found beautiful for your personality, for all of you, and not just like one small part of you. And I felt attractive, and that was so new and freeing and liberating and all of those things that, you know, you wish for people. And I've seen so many people move to Portland or met them when they first moved to Portland, especially coming from the Midwest. And I've watched them go through that process of, oh, I didn't fit into the mold in the Midwest, but here people see me, all of me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is so beautiful about Portland.
That's so great. Such a great story. Yeah. At the time, so when you moved to Portland, at the time then when you began to sort of maybe transition into like the trans part of your identity, trans folks still didn't have a lot of rights in Portland. Is that correct? Was there, you know, like, did you have, you know, did you have document? Did you have like things like you were able to change documents? You were able to, you know, healthcare covered things like medical procedures. What was going on in the trans community at that
time? I didn't transition until 2016.
Oh, okay, great.
I always say that I, you know, it was everybody else who did a lot of work to make it very easy in Oregon for me to transition.
Oh, that's so great. I'm so glad to hear that.
I kind of, you know, I went in a back door because when I wanted my breasts removed, I got them removed because I had a mutation. Doctors didn't need to know if I was happy that they were going to be gone. They didn't, you know, that didn't come into the conversation. So I was slowly chiseling off parts of myself that I didn't like and becoming Ira. But as far as the doctors were concerned, I was just having unhealthy body parts of myself removed.
You know, when so we had last week we had on Lee, and Lee was talking about how he hasn't had top surgery yet, but he's kind of going towards that, and he said that he doesn't really like, he doesn't experience gender dysphoria so much with his body the way that it is, but when he binds he experiences what he calls gender euphoria, which is like he really enjoys the feeling of like being able to go out in public and to be, you know, just get to experience the world with the body that he feels comfortable with. But he doesn't, you know, like he doesn't hate his breasts. I mean, he's eventually going to have the surgery, it sounds like. But it's not like, usually the narrative is that like, oh, you just absolutely hate your body part. You know, you've got to get rid of that right away as soon as possible. You just absolutely hate it. Was it like that for you? Or was it more just like, was it because of, you know, this trauma, honestly, and this very real fear because this mutation, you know, we're still alive talking to you
right
now. And it may very well be because you had this surgery a long time ago that we're here in this room talking.
Right. It's, the body is challenging even now. I think for my breasts or something, where there was pleasure having, and because I had mutation, I couldn't have nipples because it was too high of a risk, so I don't have any nipples. But there's, you know, fondling of a nipples and it connects you, all it goes down your whole body and awakens you. And I cut that part off.
Mm-hmm.
And even if I didn't want those breasts, I can't deny that they didn't bring me pleasure, that it didn't bring me joy when I, the few times I allowed myself to go there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there is a strangeness of not wanting this body and all of its curves still, that I have hips that I don't want, or I have, you know, this that I don't want, or that, you know, that I never, that I didn't have bottom surgery. But that I do have a body that works. And what does it mean to, for me, you know, what does it mean to risk changing something that into something that may not work, because it would be better in some ways, but I'm risking losing what I have and the joy that I can have in other ways.
I think, yeah, it's really, I mean, some of what you're talking about, I would use the language of a sensory map. So you had this sensory map of experience, of pleasure, that like you had from your body. And regardless of whether you're transgender or gender fluid or non-binary, however you identify, you know, the body that you have is the body that you experience pleasure with. And so when you transition to a different kind of body, you give up some of that sensory map that you had and some of those experiences, hopefully, in order to have another kind of experience that like you didn't have before, that maybe you're also happy with.
Yeah.
But you never really, I mean, your story is great because it's really honest. You know, I love hearing honest stories, and it makes me want to read your book even more.
Oh, thank you. I remember reading once where it was some doctor, he said he had the cure for trans, or the solution for trans people. And that was to, and I kid you not, cut off their heads and put them on like the right body, the quote unquote right body.
Okay.
And I just thought, how is that, is so disconnected from what it is to have a body. I mean, all of the memories, all of the feelings. I mean, they talk about when people get different body parts, you know, like a when there's a kidney or something, you know, and you need somebody else's kidney, that the person will have changes in their personality or changes in their physiological cravings based on the other person's body part that they're now carrying around with them. It's not just that, you know, our heads or our brains carry some information. It's all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that is a unique thing that trans people get to educate others about.
Ira, we're doing this via Zoom, so I'm able to at least see, you know, a two-dimensional image of you here. And you look like Ira to me, buddy.
Thank you.
So here's a question for you. Can you describe any perceptions of change in privilege? You know, you present, you know, by my perception here, you know, a masculine.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what's your life like now? And is that a piece of your book? Do you address that, you know, how your life has changed post-transition?
Yeah, that's more in the second book than in the first. Of course, there is privilege because I do mostly pass. And of course, sometimes I don't pass, you know? And then there's always those moments of what did you see in me that other people don't seem to notice? There's always that question, but there's an ease going through the world, definitely as a man, that I didn't have as a woman. And I don't think I could just say that it was because I feel comfortable in my body, but I do find that I feel more scared around Caucasian men than I did before, even. Because as a woman, I kind of knew what to expect and I knew how to navigate that world. But as a trans man, I don't know what they see. Sometimes they see that I'm trans and sometimes they don't. And it's weird to navigate that unknown world and not know what that's going to bring out in somebody. And so far, knock on wood, it hasn't brought out anything beyond a few jerks, but most of the time people have been pleasant. I don't come out as trans when I move through the world. Maybe I would have more in Portland if I hadn't have moved, but not in Chicago. We're not having that conversation.
Yeah.
So there's part of me that's kind of hidden.
I can relate. But then as you establish relationships, since you obviously are fairly recent, you know, transplant to Chicago, and you know, did you have an established circle of friends there, or are you, you know, in the process of establishing yourself there? I mean, what's that like?
It's been very hard. I had one friend who moved at the same time I did, and so from Portland to Chicago, so we've maintained a friendship, but as far as making new friends goes, it's been very challenging because I find myself more comfortable with women, but I don't always want to tell them I'm trans. And so then I found myself not sharing parts of myself or wondering if my interactions with them are being mistaken for interest beyond friendship. You know, the pandemic hit. I was pretty busy the first year I moved here. I was working, you know, 50, 60 hours a week. And then I was planning on, this was the year I was going to try to make friends and get out in the world. And then the pandemic hit. So I've been a little isolated. I live with my girlfriend, so that helps. And she's lived here for 20 years. So I haven't been alone. I've been introduced to her friends and things like that. But as far as making new friends, I have not been able to navigate that in any easy way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about your life, Ira, as a writer in Chicago? Is it do you find that you have access to resources or to venues that you know, maybe will open some doors for you as a transgender author?
Hopefully, there's been places to read and, you know, and that have sort of a bigger audience than there was in Portland. Stuff like that, and lots of, you know, podcasts and things like that happening that I can be connected to. It's been a slower process than I might have hoped, because I'd been focused more. I'd got a new job when I moved here, so I was focused more on that than my writing. And then as time's gone on, I'm realizing that the balance between work and focusing on my writing was not there, and that the real joy is in the writing, and I needed to have work that was a little more, less the main point of my life.
What are the steps that you have to go through as an author to get to the point where you are now, where you actually have a lot of a completed book?
Yeah, so I think this is true of any writer, but as a memoirist, it was a lot of getting the emotions out. You know, just writing all of the blech and the gunk and the blame and all of that, getting it out of my system so that when I had a finished product, it has nothing of that. And then writing, you know, the big chapters, you know, the mother dying or the father dying, like there's these big turning points in anybody's life that are easy to fit, know that it has to be in the story. But then finding those smaller moments and those smaller transitionary periods of your life that are kind of quiet and don't have as much bang for the buck, as it were, but that are just as important to the story. Laying it out, though, finding the order of it has been extremely challenging, because you could start here, you could start here, it seems like any way you start leads to a different book. Not that the story's different, but the experience of the reader is different, because I'll start with my mutation, or I'll start with my mother dying, or no, you've never met me, so why do you care that my mother died? Maybe I should start with you, you know, all of these different places. And so writing is very strange like that, where there's not necessarily one answer, and it's reworking and reworking and reworking and editing. And I use Scrivener because it's really great for reorganizing your chapters a million different ways very quickly. So I found that
Oh, that's neat. I'm gonna have to try that. I've seen it, but I've never used it.
Is there anything that you feel that you were able to bring to your writing that expands what has kind of become the standard trans narrative?
I think I would sum up the standard trans narrative as I'm in the wrong body.
Right.
Or, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not happy. I'm in the wrong body. I'll go in and I'll change the body and then I'll be happy. That would be my very brief, basic summary of it. And for me, my decision to transition wasn't born from that. I was actually happy. I was 38 years old. I dealt with the death of my parents. I had all of these surgeries so that I didn't have to be scared every day of my life that I was about to be diagnosed with some disease that was gonna kill me, you know, within a few months. I had my heart broken for the first time. It took me until I was 31 years old to have my heart broken, you know, and I finally knew once I experienced that I was actually a person truly capable of love if I could feel that much pain when somebody had left me. You know, I was writing my book. I had friends. I had girlfriends. I had a good life. I finally had a good relationship with my adopted family. And when I chose to transition, it was because I was curious what it would be to explore that part of me that I'd never given myself room to. But it wasn't because everything was wrong and I thought that transitioning was going to fix it.
That's great. So Ira, for you, what constitutes transition? I mean, at least from your experience as a body, was it getting on testosterone?
It wasn't just getting on testosterone, but that choice to hormonally transition coincided with me telling my family, this is who I am, this is how I feel, this is how I've always felt and what you've seen and didn't always like, you know, and then telling all of my friends and telling my lovers. And before I made that decision, I would have people who would notice. They'd say, well, aren't you trans, or aren't you kind of trans, or, you know, but it felt like a secret. It felt like a special secret that only some people would notice and the rest of the world was oblivious to. And so when I decided to take testosterone and tell everybody that this is who I was, it was me not letting it be the special secret anymore.
Do you think that one of the things I'm loving this conversation, and one of the things that I'm loving about it is kind of the subtlety of it and also the complexity. It's really showing, you know, that every person's story is different and that every person's story really matters. And your story, one of the things I find really interesting about your story that is probably completely normal within a certain community that I'm just not really that familiar with, is that when you, I think a lot of people might just assume that if you had had a, you know, a bilateral mastectomy, somehow you sort of had already in a way transitioned. Like even if you really hadn't, like in a way you had transitioned, because so many people associate femininity with your breasts, you know, that's like, they identify female with that. And so I'm wondering, like, how does that part of a conversation happen, like within the community that, like, you know, you valued and that you identified with? Because it sounds like when you had your, and this is part of why I'm really understanding now how your first book isn't really so much a book about, you know, you transitioning. Your first book is really like, it's your story, and being transgender is part of your story. But a lot of it is just it just sounds like it's a good story. But I'm wondering how did having your surgery, like so long before you transitioned, you know, in other ways that we might consider more traditional now, like getting on testosterone, how did that affect how you saw yourself in all of those years before you transitioned?
It was a very interesting time, because when I finally looked down at my chest after that surgery, even though I had been so scared for so long that I would regret, thunder and lightning, Thunder. That I would regret having the surgery because I would miss my body parts. It was what I had always wanted. You know, there was that part of me that was like, yes, it wasn't a figment of my imagination that I wanted to have a flat chest. It was real because I can feel the realness of it and the joy every time I look at it. And as I walked through the world, because I did not, you know, I did not wear, I call them falsies. I don't know what they're really called, but when my mom had her mastectomy and she put her things in her bra, she called them her falsies. So that's how I've called them since I was a kid. But I didn't augment my breasts after the surgery. I just walked around through the world with a flat chest. And I was surprised how many people did not notice that I had no breast. Like people that I would later become friends with, and I'd say, well, what did you think of my chest? I didn't even notice it. And then other people were completely thrown off. They started calling me he, or they just looked at me sideways. My brother, I didn't know this at the time, but after I transitioned, he said, you know, it's so different walking through the world with you after you've transitioned, because before everybody would look at you and they were trying to figure you out, but I just kind of blocked it out. You know, I just completely tuned it out.
The way that people perceive us is an absolutely automatic brain function, and the clues that they are looking at, you know, are both physiological, but not so much. And so your comments just a moment ago are really reinforcing in terms of how we are perceived by others, in that it's how we project ourselves, not so much our physical presentation. I don't know, our eyes, our speech, our postures, you know, all of these other clues, the way that human beings communicate, is so much more, so much more than visually or verbally. Yeah. It's energetic in nature. Right. And yeah. So both your experience pre-transition and your experience post-transition, I think that's a fascinating perspective that you bring into our community. You need to write more. You need to write a lot about that.
Okay.
There's multiple chapters, if not almost a whole short book there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Because transition happens from within. Mm-hmm. Can I get an amen there? Yeah, it does. It's our presentation has something to do with it, but that's, yeah, mm-hmm. No, we have.
No, because you know you're in the.
All on the radio can't see the screen on Zoom, but we're all shaking our heads. Now, yeah,
yeah.
Ira, is there somewhere where people can see any samples of your work or learn more about you as an author?
Yeah, I have a website. It's irafeinstein.com. So my last name is F as in Frank, E as in elephant, I as in igloo, N as in no, S as in Sam, T as in Tom, E as in elephant, I as in igloo, N as in no, and then Ira, just IRA at the front. Yep, there you go.
Yeah. That's so great. We've been talking tonight with Ira Feinstein. Ira is an author, a transgender author. We first met on the group Transgender Writers, which is a group on Facebook for folks who want to connect with other transgender writers. And I did not know that we would have a Portland connection. It's been such a pleasure talking with you, Ira. Is there anything that we didn't get to in our conversation tonight that you feel like you would like to share with us that we didn't address?
No, this was great. This is great.
Well, Ira, I really appreciate you spending time talking with us tonight, and I really look forward to seeing your book. I really wish you the best of luck with it. Your story sounds both really heartbreaking and very moving. Maybe one last question I might ask you. I should have asked you this at the beginning, but who are some of your favorite authors? Who do you like to read when you're just relaxing and not writing?
Annie Ernaux, I think that's how you say her last name. She's a French writer. She's very poetic. She's probably my favorite. Or Gretel Erlichsen. She wrote The Solace of Open Spaces. And she has the ability to write about holding space with somebody when you know they're going to die and enjoying those last moments that I haven't found anybody else able to capture. So I don't really like fun reading, obviously. I wanna feel. So those are two of my favorites.
Great, thank you. Jean, do you have any last questions?
No, I don't. I will simply say, what a pleasure having a conversation with you this evening, Ira. An honor, yeah. And best of luck with the book and the second book, because I know it's a challenge. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you both so much.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hi everyone, I'm Henry, and I'd like to invite you to listen to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.